history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories right there around you that really need to be told, and we have the privilege of hearing them here each week as we seek to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot, we're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The story you're going to hear today is told in a pretty new book called I Wanted to Be a Pilot, The Making of a Tuskegee Airman. That Tuskegee Airman happens to be Frank Macon, 96 years old, of Colorado Springs, Colorado. And everybody knows who the Tuskegee Airmen are now, the trailblazing African-American pilots of World War II. But you certainly weren't thinking about that growing up as a boy here in Colorado Springs. The Air Force Academy wasn't here yet. It was a long way off at that point. What was your childhood like here in Colorado Springs?
I was raised by two great aunts and an uncle. It was really great. I had a lot of fun and got into a lot of mischief, just like all the rest of the kids in the neighborhood. In fact, the book was written about some of the kids. And I always say that in the neighborhood, and I sit on the porch and I just told them they shouldn't do those things. But I got blamed for everything that happened in the neighborhood. There was a thing that the people in the neighborhood said, that boy, Ms. Macon's, will never live to be 21 because of the mischief that he's getting and the things that he was doing. And I fooled him.
I guess you did, because you don't even look 96 as we're sitting here talking. And as far as you getting blamed for everything, did you feel that was because of racial prejudice or just they didn't want to take the blame?
No, it was because I did. I did it. And
so you weren't as innocent as you sounded there, huh?
No, I wasn't. And the neighborhood that I grew up in, I still live in it, but anyway, it was very diverse as far as racial comes. There were Mexicans and very, very, very few blacks or colored or Negro or however they termed us in those days. And a lot of whites and everybody was of a lower middle class. And they all had to work. And there were gold miners and coal miners and ranchers, all of that. And that's who I grew up around. And people that were very innovative because the Depression was on, you know. Mm-hmm. And we had to forge for ourselves, and they did very well.
Well, and I've talked to a lot of people who lived through the Depression and the perspective that they have as a result. But I'm just trying to imagine where we are back in those days, because you're right by Interstate 25, but that wasn't here yet.
The highway to Denver was just a two-lane road, and part of it was paved and part of it wasn't. Of course, the railroad tracks were there, and the highway came in several years after the war.
Well, and I'm just imagining, I mean, the stories you hear about the Depression, people have a hard time finding enough food to eat, let alone gas for a car. And in this part of the country, at this altitude, you get a heck of a lot of snow. That couldn't have been easy to deal with in those days.
Well, yeah, but we survived, and everybody depended on everybody. In the fall of the year, they went deer hunting. The kids in the neighborhood, they would hang the carcasses up, and they would skin them, and we would have to scrape the hides. They would sell them for a whopping $5 a piece. And if you planted a garden, most of the neighborhood went with pitchforks and helped you dig up and plant the garden, and then you'd help the next one. So there was a lot of cooperation. We didn't see, as they have now, people standing on the corners with signs that said, please help. We took care of each other. Of course, they had things like the government finally came up with programs to put people to work. WPA and things like that. In 1935, around Labor Day, we had a flood that took out a lot of the neighborhood, and the creek that caused all the problems, they got out and widened it. And it was basically done by hand, so to speak. A drawbar with, hooked to horses and things like that. And we widened the creek and put, if you see alongside the embankment, they've got rock. And all this was done up in the mountains. They built new reservoirs and highways and things like that. And people actually went to work. They just were not laying around asking somebody to take care of them or the government or anything like that. They were just used to doing that.
And I understand you became interested in aviation at a very young age. Is that right?
Oh, yes. There was an aircraft factory that was up in the north end of town, and it was called Alexander Aircraft. They built the Eagle Rock and the Eagle Rock Bullet. Every chance I could get, I'd sneak up there and watch them build the airplanes. And the factory finally had to shut down because of the Depression. But they had the airfield up, and they would take the aircraft across the road, which was the highway, over there to the little airfield, and they would do some testing and flying them. And, some of the airplanes were successful, and they had a little problems with some of the others.
Yeah, I think people forget how primitive aviation was then. I mean, you're only a couple decades into the existence of aircraft. But so that young, you dreamed of being a pilot someday?
Well, yes, and they would take me flying, and they saw that I had expressed a great interest in the aircraft, but it was the mechanics of the aircraft that I was interested in, as well as the flying.
So what was the first aircraft you ever went up in, and what did that feel like?
Well, as I stated in the book, there was a family that lived, the Warden family that lived next door to me, and they had been ranchers and they had moved to town. And there was two girls there, and these girls were dating some of the pilots up there. And when my folks had to go to work or something, well, they would babysit me. And they would just take me out there at the airport with them, and I was sitting up there flying with them. And I didn't realize, you know, no big deal. And so I got to very early age. And then, of course, I was trying to build my own wings and jumped off the chicken house and trying to fly. And I didn't have very successful landings.
I was going to say, how did that work when you jumped off the chicken coop?
Not very successful. It's a good thing the ground was plowed underneath.
And that little airfield you're talking about, where you got your first taste of flying, I believe they're still using that area for aviation today. Maybe a different scale a little bit?
Yeah, that's where the Air Force Academy teaches their glider pilots. It was called Pine Valley Airport. They're going to rename it to Benjamin Davis Field. And, of course, as a Tuskegee Airman, we go out and talk to the cadets a lot. And I tell them this is where I made my first successful solo in high school, is off this field.
And for people who aren't familiar, you're very familiar with the name that you just said, Benjamin Davis. But for people who don't know who that is, why don't you explain his significance?
This Benjamin Davis was the, his father was one of the first black generals. And of course, he went to West Point. And then there's quite a story about him and how they didn't talk to him the whole time he was there. But anyway, then he took over and learned to fly, and with when they started teaching the black pilots to fly. It's quite a story about how that all came about. And most of the military didn't want Roosevelt to authorize the service. And Mrs. Roosevelt, she pushed for him to do it. And I called her the mother of black aviation because she really forced it. And then she went down and flew with one of the pilots down there at Tuskegee. And it's quite a story. You could read about it. Pappy Anderson, as we called him, and she flew with him, and then she come back. And the Secret Service didn't want her to do it, and then called him and tried. And he said, "Well, I can't tell her anything. And she's going to do it. She's going to do it." So, that was that. You know, of course, the success that Tuskegee Airmen had overseas was is well documented.
Yes, of course. Books, documentaries, the feature film Red Tails that you may have seen. There's a wealth of material chronicling the contributions of the Tuskegee Airmen during World War II. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, I have linked for you an article from the FDR Library about Eleanor Roosevelt's early support for African American aviation. And to elaborate on Frank's comments about General Benjamin O. Davis Jr., the man for whom the airstrip where Frank Macon first flew is going to be named, Davis was the leader of the Tuskegee Airmen in World War II, commanding the 332nd Fighter Group and personally flying 60 missions in P-39s, P-40s, P-47s, and P-51s. There's no shortage of heroics from those pioneering pilots, of course, but Davis took great pride in the spotless record of Red Tail escorts. Not a single bomber was ever lost when being escorted by the Tuskegee Airmen over more than 200 missions in the skies over Europe. Eventually, Davis would become the first African-American general in the history of the Air Force. He's buried at Arlington National Cemetery. A barracks is named in his honor at West Point, where, as Frank mentioned, Davis was once ostracized for the color of his skin. And at the start of November, before the Air Force Academy hosts Army in football, that airfield that is clearly visible from the Academy's Falcon Stadium will be formally renamed in honor of General Benjamin O. Davis, Jr. Davis passed away in 2002, but his autobiography is a great read. Its title, Benjamin O. Davis, Jr., American. It underscores his desire to be measured by his character and what he accomplished, to succeed as an American, as the book's jacket states, and not to fail because of color. So you might want to add that book to your list, along with Frank Macon's new book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot. It's linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we're going to hear more of the story in the book and more of the story behind the book when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with Frank Macon, 96 years old, of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Nationwide, there are fewer than 50 pilots remaining now who earned their wings outside of Tuskegee, Alabama in World War II as part of the then-segregated U.S. military's aviation program for African-American servicemen. Frank is one of them, and his life story has taken some twists and turns he did not expect. You can read all about it in his new book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot, which we have linked for you online. And Frank, you mentioned that by the time you were in high school, you had already soloed at Pine Valley Airport, now on the U.S. Air Force Academy property. So I guess you'd come a long way from jumping off the top of the chicken coop, and you were achieving some of your aviation dreams. But how were you doing in school?
Terrible. I'm very dyslexic, and they didn't understand that problem that people that are dyslexic that have. And now they, of course, very farther advanced in it, and they're helping a lot of. But I did have a very good memory, so that helped a lot. I learned by the words would move around on the paper in a book or something, and numbers were just terrible. And if I put my finger on them and use my finger, I could stabilize the words a lot better. And so that's how I learned to read.
But you kind of had to figure that all out on your own? No one was helping you?
Yeah, I just figured it out on my own. But anyway, it was really strange. Today, I can't figure out how I passed those tough tests that they gave us to be able to fly. But a lot of the questions they asked had to do with science and physics. And I really enjoyed physics and chemistry and auto mechanics and the things that we did in, I'll say, junior high school and high school here in Colorado Springs. And I got quite a good education in that field. And physics was one of my favorite subjects, and how things work. And it just always amazes me, even today, how the Creator put this world and the whole creation together. Many years later, I'm jumping ahead, I retired from civil service at Fort Carson, and I was asked to join a research company. I'm just awed by how wonderful that this world and the creation, and it just amazes me how the trees know when to turn, when to put the leaves on, when to drop them, when to go. And just all of that. I'm just like a little 10-year-old kid. I'm just always amazed at everything.
Well, there's a lot of scenery around here that can amaze you, too. You said you've been in this neighborhood pretty much your whole life, and Pike's Peak, I think we could throw a rock to if we had a good enough arm out your back porch here, and the Garden of the Gods not too far away. I guess there's a question, too, just out of curiosity. Did you have much opportunity to explore the nature around here as a boy?
Oh, yeah. We were always hiking the mountains and whatnot and picking up different minerals. Of course, the grade school I went to, this neighborhood was either gold miners or coal miners. Of course, there was always an argument which one of them was a miner, but and they expected us to fall in line with our parents in the mining industry. Geology, I learned a lot just because they felt that we were going to be miners.
You were talking about how good your memory is, so I've got to ask you about December 7th, 1941, because most of the people I've met who are alive then have some kind of memory of how they found out what happened out at Pearl Harbor. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. Well, what I remember is, as I said, I always wanted to be a pilot. I was driving at 14, probably driving before then because, but anyway, my great uncle just went down to the police station. He couldn't drive, and my mama had arthritis real bad. And he asked, said, that kid knows how to drive. Is all right if he's driving? And they said, oh, yeah, as long as somebody's with him. Now, I took them to a friend's house. I don't know. I was just driving around with the car. There's a girl that used to live in the neighborhood, and I went by to see her. And she says, well, I guess you're going to be a pilot now. And I said, what? And she says, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And I said, what's that? You know, I never heard of Pearl Harbor. And that's how I actually got involved. Of course, turned the old car radio on, and between the static and whatnot, and they would talk about that. I joined the Civil Air Patrol, and then this is where I really started learning about airplanes. And they would take us flying and teach us how to manipulate the controls, you know. My coordination was always been good. I was on the tumbling team and things like that, you know. And when I graduated from high school, they said they've started a new program in the colleges and started teaching. They told me about Tuskegee. I never heard of it, but, you know, and it was in Flying Magazine. He told me that I could go to there, to college, and the government would pay for it, you know. And I had to go to the new Customs House in Denver and take the test to see if I could qualify. They wanted to put me in the Army Air Corps, and I said, well, I'm supposed to go to the civilian pilot training program, and they called me in and said, you're too young. You have to be 21 to get a commercial license. And so they sent me home. Even after I'd gotten out of school, I would not have been 21, you know. So I came back, went back to work at the old garage, working on automobiles. So the draft board started looking at me, and I went back, took the test, and I got in and got, and then went to Keesler Field. Boy, oh, that was a tough test. And a lot of was about your physical coordination and whatnot. But you had to have 2 years of college to go to flight school. Well, I just got out of high school. So they sent me to Tuskegee to college. I was there a little while, and I don't know, 3 or 4 months. They sent me to Maxwell Field to take the test again. And they said, well, you more than qualify for 2 years of college. And so then they sent me to the base.
And I'm just curious, because this is, you know, most of the people listening weren't alive during that time period. And maybe they've heard some stories, but they didn't live through it. The fact that our nation's military at the time was segregated, that Japanese Americans were isolated over here, that African Americans weren't serving with whites in the same unit. How did that strike you? Did that disturb you? Did it seem odd? Or was that the way things were then?
I wasn't used to being down south, and I wasn't used to that because the school I went to was integrated. Native Americans, Mexicans, and blacks were all, and along Irish and everybody else was, you know. And so it was just really confusing to me. And water, I had to go into this bathroom or a toilet, you know, facility. Or I couldn't drink out of this fountain and all of that. And it was just really ridiculous. And I had just never been involved in anything like that.
And, of course, a lot of these pilots that you're studying with and training with had grown up in the South and had a much different experience. How eye-opening was that for you to glean some of what they'd been through?
The thing was that, well, I couldn't understand anything they were saying, and they couldn't understand anything I was saying. When they found out I came from Colorado, well the first thing was, we're fighting the Indians all the time, you know. And, of course, I'd just play it up. And my grandfather was an Indian. And they wanted to know, well, how do you do out there? I said, well, of course he wasn't. I said, well, my grandfather's chief of the tribe, you know. And the guys from Denver, there was some in there, you know, and they just help along with them. There were so many phraseology I was used to. I just had no knowledge of the way they talked, and it was really confusing. In basic, we were in Biloxi, Mississippi. It was strange. I don't know how to put it, but having to go to a separate restroom or something like that. And I said, well, I'll be glad I get out of this place, you know. And then, of course, got to Tuskegee. And Tuskegee's really not in the town of Tuskegee. It's in a place called Greenwood. It's a suburb. And if you went to Tuskegee, the town, the atmosphere was much different. You could just feel it, you know. But out in Greenwood, you just didn't see any whites. Of course, now when we got to, and our instructor were all black. But then when we got to the air base, started in basic and advanced, all of those were whites. And a lot of them are from the north, so they weren't too bad.
And, you know, with the lens of history, we can look back now and say that what all of you did during World War II, the African-American soldiers, sailors, airmen who risked their lives, laid the groundwork for the civil rights movement, that they showed our blood is just as red as any other American, that if we can die for our country, we deserve some rights. We say that now, but did you guys have a sense then that there was something you had a chance to prove?
Now, I don't know about the rest of the group, but I didn't feel that I had anything to prove. I knew what I could do, and I had learned to fly before I even went there, and they cautioned me here, never mention that you know how to fly. So I didn't, and an airplane was just as normal as an automobile to me. So my mindset was not as the others.
Well, you hadn't dealt with the degree of prejudice in your life that they had, I guess.
No, and the other thing is, I felt much different than most of them because I just didn't seem to think like they thought, you know. I was practically raised with white people, you know, and they used to say that, what do they call it? Say that you're an Oriole, you're dark on the outside and white on the inside. Mm-hmm. You know. And I guess that's true, but I didn't realize it.
You said people here in Colorado Springs warned you when you get to Tuskegee, don't tell them you already know how to fly. Why did they tell you that? What was the concern?
The concern was that they would expect more out of me, or they may make it harder on me because, you know, I'm a smart aleck. That's the way I interpreted it, but I didn't tell them.
What all did you get to fly while you were there?
I got to fly the Stearman biplane, which was really a lot of fun, open cockpit and all like that, the real flying. Mm-hmm. And then I got to fly the Volte Vibrator, as they called it. It was a BT-13 made by Volte. Then the T-6, of which I really enjoyed flying the T-6. It was very maneuverable. Well, the Stearman was renewable, but it was sluggish and slow, you know.
And the T-6 is to prepare you to go overseas, and I'm sure you had ideas of flying one of those red-tailed P-51s, but that's not how it worked out.
No, just before graduation, I knew that I had my uniform, officer's uniform, and everything was hanging in the closet, you know, and I had a real nasty head cold, but I loved flying that T-6. And I said, well, I'll go to the dispensary after this flight. Well, I did, with blood coming out of my ears, you know. And of course, now that little incident just ruined my flying career. But I did get into a lot of flying, but not commercial type, because after I got on, but I got into maintenance and engineering and things like that, and had a fairly successful life, I'd say.
Well, yeah, and you're not done. In fact, now you've got this new book out that people everywhere are reading and learning some of this history, and I know part of the reason you wrote that book is to inspire young people, including those who battle dyslexia, as you did. But with the situation with that flight, where you just couldn't resist going up in that T-6, and you ruptured both eardrums, is that what happened?
Both of them, yeah. Uh-huh. And I was deaf for several weeks and in the hospital at the Scott Field. And then they sent me to radio code school, which brought a lot of my hearing back.
I'm just interested, because, you know, everybody has challenges in their life. Everybody faces adversity. It's hard when you don't know where the finish line is or where the light at the end of the tunnel is. And when here you've described how much you loved flying, and now all of a sudden not only can you not fly, you can't even hear for weeks on end. What was that time period like? What was going through your mind?
I got to get better. Was the best thing. And I guess I'm a fighter, you know, and I don't dwell on what could be, and I dwell on what's going to be. And I'm still the same way. The war was over with when I finally got out of the hospital. But they sent me back to Tuskegee to finish up with another class. But when it happened, the war was over with, and they said I'd have to re-up because my time was real close of getting out. And I thought about it a while, and I said, oh, I know, I don't put up with this graded service. I can go home. I know how to fly, so that's it, and I'll make it. But in retrospect, I can say I should have done it, but that was should have, I didn't. But they're bugging me to write another book about what I did do after I got out of the military, because I was kind of involved in a lot of science things and research programs, things like that. And I don't know what I can write and can't write, because I don't know how much is still secret and what is.
Well, that sounds pretty intriguing. And we can look forward, perhaps, to this 96-year-old writing another book. But there's quite a story about how his first book came about. Again, you can find that book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot, linked at hometownheroesradio.com or his personal website, franklinmacon.com. More of Frank's thoughts on being one of the last remaining Tuskegee Airmen when we come back. Plus, we're going to hear from the woman who worked with Frank for 4 years to make his book a reality. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing today on 96-year-old Frank Macon of Colorado Springs, Colorado, and his new book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot, The Making of a Tuskegee Airman. If you check out the cover of the book at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll see the authors listed as Franklin J. Macon with Elizabeth G. Harper. But I think you'll appreciate hearing from Mrs. Harper as well. The wife of an Air Force Academy grad and career officer, Liz has quite a story to tell about the origins of this new book.
Well, I met Frank, I think it was like 2006. We were stationed here, and our good friends, Chris and Cindy, I was having dessert with Cindy, and we ran into Frank and his girlfriend, Amy. It was just a fast introduction, passing by kind of thing. And then Cindy, later, while we were eating, was telling me all these funny stories about Frank, like blowing things up with carbide and dipping girls' ponytails in the inkwell, and that he was a Tuskegee Airman. And that kind of just stuck in my brain. And then we were stationed up in Cheyenne, and a couple of good friends of mine, Deanna and Stephanie, we started doing projects, starting to research, write books, because we had boys and girls, but we realized that our boys didn't have much that they liked to read. They were more outdoorsy, woodsy, liking to do adventures. So we started that, and then we TCS back to Colorado Springs. So bump it up 10 years later, we had dinner with Chris and Cindy. And Chris and Cindy know Frank because of Chris's metal fabrication shop. Frank and Chris have tinkered for years, designed things, probably for almost 3 decades now. And we asked how Frank was doing and was he still speaking to schools and that sort of thing. And Chris said, oh, yeah. And I was at the Griffith Center, which is for troubled and adjudicated kids at the time. And I thought, well, I'll have Frank come speak. And so he did. He went multiple times. And I knew the kids were always mesmerized by him. Even these kids who normally wouldn't sit for 5 minutes would sit and listen to Frank tell these stories for like an hour and a half and not even move. So that always struck me as well. And then at that dinner, Chris said, we have to get Frank in the air again. He's going to be 92. And I thought, well, we live at the Air Force Academy. I should be able to figure that out. So we made some phone calls and they just took it and ran. The Academy gave Frank a birthday flight, and then he spoke to all the freshman history classes, and then they introduced him at Mitchell Hall in front of all 3,000-plus cadets to a standing ovation, and I drove him that day, even though he can drive, or he could drive until this past summer, because I knew he'd be tired. And on the way home, he said, all those reporters, everybody, whenever we do an event, they want me to write a book. And I said, well, why don't you, Frank? And he says, well, I'm dyslexic. And I just said, well, you want some help? And we started the next week, and here we are 4 years later with a book in hand and a great friendship, and just it's gone from there. So that's kind of how the whole thing happened. It was really quite providential.
Sure sounds like it. What would you say was the most incredible thing or maybe an overarching theme that you picked up on from all the time you spent with him putting this book together over the last 4 years?
Well, there's two. Frank has never let anything get in his way. And the other thing, even in the midst of things that were not always easy for him as a kid, like the dyslexia, not knowing his mom and dad, the racial elements of growing up in that time frame, Frank does not have an angry bone in his body. And a lot of times when we go and speak, the kids all want to play. They make the toys that are in his book. And they're all, you know, how did you do this? How did you jump off the chicken coop? And we find that the adults always kind of want to make the discussion about race, and that is not what Frank is about. He so wants to leave a legacy and help kids, and he doesn't care if you're rich, you're poor, you're black or white, purple, green, he would say. It doesn't matter. He wants to help those kids, and he will change the direction of the conversation even, because he is not an angry person. He just, I don't know, he always says, you know, God gave us all a purpose, and that's what he wants to focus on. He wants kids to know, because he could be really upset with the fact that he didn't know who his real mom and dad were. He will change that when somebody asks him, who is your real father, and when did you figure that out? He learned who it was when he was in his early 20s, and he will just say, but that's where I got my mechanical skills from. Everybody says my father was a good mechanic. And so he focuses on the positive. And he said it to me again the other day, because I said, what would you say to kids who are struggling, say, with dyslexia or other things? And he says, you can't listen to what other people are telling you. God gave you a purpose. You have to find what you're good at, and you go for that. So that has always struck me. And I think it strikes the adults who are around him as well, because he could choose to be kind of bitter just because of some of his circumstances, but there isn't an angry or a bitter bone in his body.
Who is this book for, and what do you hope people get out of it when they read it?
Well, by trade, I'm a teacher, and Frank wanted to help kids. So when we sat down and purposely, he's had so many interesting facts about history, but the goal was to really reach kids, to get them interested in history. Even kids who wouldn't normally pick up a book, it's written as if Frank's talking to a class, so it's great for a teacher or a grandparent or a parent to read to a child. And our goal was just to help kids find their niche, find a purpose, never to quit. And I know that kind of maybe sounds cliche, but Frank has had so many, you know, interactions with famous people. He's related to Frederick Douglass. His grandpa was a Buffalo soldier. You know, so all these things happened around him, and it didn't even faze him. He just knew he wanted to fly, and he was going to fly, and so be it. I mean, he jumped off the chicken coop, like I said, and all kinds of things. So our goal then, we sat down and decided to focus the book to the middle reader, which is like fourth grade through eighth grade. Adults really like it as well. But that was when Frank struggled the most in school, so that's the age group we targeted, because he wants to help kids who struggle with school. I'm just grateful for our friendship. You know, we've spent so much time. I'm just grateful for my kids. I get choked up. Talk about it. My son's birthday is the same day as Frank's. And what a blessing. You know, my 14-year-old gets to hang out with a World War II hero. And what do? They make parachutes together and throw them off the stairwell, because that's just who Frank is. He's so fun-loving. He's just a treasure. You know, that to me is more important than whatever comes of all these events and the book. Sorry, I get kind of emotional, but it just really is so amazing to me. I grew up in Michigan. Frank grew up out here. My husband grew up in Georgia. Our kids have this great privilege. I hope that people just realize what a privilege that generation is, and we're short on time. And I hope that they spend some time, if they know somebody of that age group, just sit and visit with them. They're just amazing, you know. It's hard to even put in words, really. But really, by the grace of God, our families cross paths, and it's just been a treasure for all of us.
And now we have this book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot, that I'm sure many who are listening right now are going to order and treasure themselves. That was Liz Harper, who wrote the book with Frank, and I promised you more of Frank. I'm sure you get asked this a lot when you go out and speak. The legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen. How do you explain it? What gives you the most pride when it comes to being associated with that legendary group?
Well, I could say that they proved the people really, really wrong that was against us. And unfortunately, Lindbergh was one of the top people that was against us learning to fly. In later years, I've heard guys come up to me that said, you know, I was flying a B-17. Were you one of those guys? You saved my life. And all like that. And I said, no, I'm sorry, I wasn't one of them, but I know some of the guys that were. I'm afraid that would have been very hard to control, because You know, if I'd have seen an enemy airplane, I would have probably broke formation and went out after him. But most of the guys stayed right, like Davis said, you stick right with those bombers. And the fighters were intermingled with the bombers so that the fighters couldn't get in. They were the first to shoot down that jet that they...
The German ME-262?
Yeah. At meetings, some of them would laugh about how they did it. They would tease it, keep it up because they knew the fuel consumption was right pretty terrible, and they'd keep it up until it ran out of fuel. And, of course, then it was a glider, so they could get it, you know. They quit sending them up after those. When they knew the red tails were there, they just forget it. They didn't bother.
Well, and you mentioned that you go out to the academy and talk to cadets. You've written this book to tell your story, and in ways the story of the Tuskegee Airmen as well. In all your associations with other Tuskegee Airmen over the years, what have you drawn from that? What are some of the things that you treasure and hold on to?
Well, the association and the know that they suffered, or I suffered some of the embarrassments that they did. Some of those guys, when they got off the ship and come back, they had the sign colored on this side and whites on that side, you know. And the officers' club, a lot of them, they couldn't go in there until finally these guys found out that these are the guys who are saving our lives. And then the officers forced them to let them come into the officers' club.
You were already out of the service when this happened. But when you heard that President Truman was integrating the armed forces, that segregation, as far as our military was concerned, was no more, what did that mean to you?
Well, I was ready to go back in, and as I was saying, I was working out of Carson, and this colonel just said, no, you're not, and he got me out of it because I had the papers to go back in. I was in the reserves.
Well, as you said, you spent decades working on airplanes. You know, I don't know how much you can talk about there because you said some of it may still be secret, but one of the things I read about you, that you helped with modifications and improvements on a lot of different airplanes, and that you even became an accident investigator and suggested some changes that may save lives as far as air travel is concerned?
Yeah, that when I got out of Fort Carson, a research company here, and it was made up of ex-cadets from the Air Force Academy. There was an aircraft at a DC-3 that went into the seawall in Boston. They got the, from the FAA, they got the contract to try to determine what caused the accident. And so there was a fellow that I knew that I had been associated with because of his family, and they were involved in the Alexander Aircraft Factory. He told them about me and said that I need to get a hold of them. I got the records from the FAA, and I read them over and got thinking about it. And I said, well, the new pilots learn to fly instruments and learn, and they're told that you trust the instruments and not your feelings. At which old pilots, that instrument panel could be blank, as far, you know, and they trusted their senses, you know. So I said that something went wrong with the instrument. I got the autopilot, a model of it, and got it in the lab, and I said, well, this thing's working all right. It can't. And I got to thinking, you start at the accident and work back, and that was what I was taught. So I went back, and I finally figured out that there must have been something in the electrical system that overloaded it and wiped out the autopilot, and they thought they were at the 500-foot descent or whatever they had set for descent speed, and the needle was sitting right on there, and so they just said, well, we're okay. But it was a real heavy fog, and why radar didn't pick it up, I don't know. And of course, that wasn't what I was supposed to look for.
Right.
So I just figured it was somewhere in the electrical system. So they got to checking that, and the alternator regulator went out on them, and that's what happened.
So because of that electrical issue, their computerized or automatic altimeter was giving them a reading that was inaccurate. They thought they had more space.
Yeah. And so then they got busy and corrected that system.
Well, and just so I understand clearly, the situation with the airliner in Boston that crashed, and that crash killed everyone aboard the plane, you, through your detective work, figure out what had gone wrong. The fix prevents that from happening again. So, in theory, your determination and your skill in deciphering that saved a lot of lives.
Oh, well, yeah, I've thought about that and said, well, you did do something.
Yeah. Well, and you've hinted that you did a lot more, but some of it may still be classified. Are there any hints you can give us, some general ideas of the kind of stuff you're working on?
Well, a lot of laser stuff. The way it was set up, I was presented with one problem, and I overcame that. The guy in the next office was given a problem, and all of this, and I don't know, some lab in Mississippi probably got something else, and then this was all taken to some place like Kirtland Air Force Base, and they put all this information. So I don't know what I...
So they had to separate different elements of the project so no one would know all of it.
That's why I can't say what it was, because I don't know. But I knew some of it had to do with lasers.
Well, how do you scratch your aviation itch these days?
I started learning to fly gliders, and oh, I love that. And that's real skill. A few months ago, a fella came down from Denver and took me a ride in a T-6, and we were doing barrel rolls and all kinds of maneuvers. It's just like I hadn't been out of that airplane a week. And all this, it all came back to me.
And it had been 75 years.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. But the problem was trying to get in and out of that airplane. I wasn't 20 years old. Uh-huh.
You're not on the tumbling team anymore?
No. But really, truly, I've had some problems like everybody else, but I've had more fun in life and had accomplished a lot of things, and I feel pretty happy about it.
Well, maybe that's my last question, and if you have anything to add, feel free. But I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that only you could tell us. I hope people read that story in your book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot. But you just said what a great life you've had. Is there something that you would say you're most proud of in life?
Living, I guess. Being able to have the opportunity. You know, when I was coming along, the Negro family, people would say, oh, the white folks won't let us do this, and the white folks won't. And it was a fight. White folks was pushing me to do these things. So I didn't listen to them. They just didn't want to do it, that's all. They just rather complain than get it done. I never was. I'll complain about something, but it's, but I always find a way that I can get around that situation. I can say I've had a lot of help, and that was, I think, my curiosity is what people were interested in to help me. And I help myself. I don't stand around, well, I can't do this and I can't do that. No. By the time they can't do it, I've got it done. You know, that's just the way I am. And I depend on me to get her done. People say, well, you're 96. Well, you want to be doing that. Oh, get out of my way. I can get to, you know. By the time you try to do something for me, I've got it done.
Well, then maybe you're the guy to ask this question, because I'm just thinking, I hear your perspective, and correct me if I'm wrong, but even though you are aware of the segregated military, you didn't think that was right. Your lens wasn't always focused on racial issues. That wasn't your priority or focus.
I don't have time to be focusing on that and complaining and all like that. Yeah. You know, but I just get into it.
So I'm just curious, because in today's world, even though our military's integrated and the civil rights movement has happened, they're still in the news, you hear about racial tensions and you hear the verbal volleys being fired back and forth. What advice do you have for all of us in navigating that? What do you think could help us get it right?
Shut up and get something done. And quit complaining and quit looking at that, because I don't look at a white person. I do not look at a, quote, black person. And those terminologies, I have never seen a white person in my life, and I've never seen a black one. You take a piece of paper, a white, and put your hand on her, you're not white. I take that same black piece of paper and put it on her. And this color and dividing people up by color or something like that is stupid, just absolutely stupid.
You know what I didn't ask you, because, I mean, all your time in the air, did you ever have some scares, some close calls, some moments where you weren't sure if that landing was going to go quite right?
Flying is many moments of boredom, all shared by a few split seconds of sheer terror. I was in a real serious helicopter crash at Carson. What had happened was this young pilot was wanting to become a maintenance officer. They asked me to go out with him and explain to him things that he should look for if a pilot comes in and complains. And then they could go and tell the mechanic the problem, and the mechanic would know personally where to go take care of it, you know. We had some engine problems. I, in a way, blame myself for this, because this engine wasn't running right. And first place, I'd have to back up a little bit. First place, there was a lot of problems was happening around there because guys didn't want to go overseas, and they'd do a little something, you know, and messing with the things that it happened to be that this, I felt that it was because I had just lifted this that morning, the very air, and it was, I run the engine up and it was fine, and I think somebody messed with it. We took off and flew around, and he put it, the engine in idle to come into the land, and it quit. Engine, I said, well, you got rotor speed, just keep your rotor speed up, we'll be all right. And because, you know, when you get close to the ground, you call what they call a collective, and it changes the pitch of the blades, and you get a cushion, and you just sit down. It's no problem. And he said, you think we should go around again? And that little small voice in my head said no. But I said, yeah, let's give it another go. This time the engine caught, and then it quit again, and he panicked, and he pulled the collective in too high and killed all the energy in the blades, and we hit like a ton of rock, and it rolled up, and it was a type of helicopter that you see on MASH. It rolled over, hit a mud puddle. It had been raining, and it hit a mud puddle and flipped over and landed on the side I was on, of course. But there was a hole where some of the instruments went through the bubble, and it was happened to be in the summertime. We didn't have the doors on there. That's another thing. Lucky, and we jumped out and come out there. But I got bruised up, but I didn't break anything. I got bruised up pretty bad. In fact, I've got an ankle that lets me know that it's still around. But anyway, I had plenty of time, civil service time, and so they gave me a medical retirement from that. And that's how I got away from Carson. And while I was recovering, that's when I got that job with the research company.
How do you explain your story? Because I'm just thinking about it. A kid born to a teenage mother, raised by his aunts, struggles to read, looks at the page and the numbers and the letters are all over the place, and it's detective work just to try to figure out what's said there, that he could learn to fly as a teenager, be part of a legendary group of pilots known as the Tuskegee Airmen, do life-saving research on the highest tech aeronautical machines in the country. That doesn't sound like a story that unfolds every day. How do you explain it?
Well, I'm not a what you call a religious person, but saying that, I do believe in a supreme being, and I think that this supreme being said, this is going to be your job, mister, and get her done.
He continues to do that at age 96. Frank Macon of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Check out his book online and join us again next time on Hometown Heroes when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.